I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation, what you can do to cut carbon emissions. But first, some of the 15 British sailors and Marines held captive for nearly 2 weeks by Iran held an extraordinary news conference today, during which they said they were kept in isolation and told they would spend 7 years in prison if they didn't confess to illegally entering Iranian waters. Lieutenant Felix Carman described the first days of their capture.
Throughout the night, we were subjected to random interrogations. The questions were aggressive and the handling rough, but it was no worse than that. The following morning, we were flown to Tehran and transported to a prison where the atmosphere changed completely. We were blindfolded, our hands were bound, and we were forced up against the wall. Throughout our ordeal, we faced constant psychological pressure.
The men also said today that the female sailor, Faye Turney, who wasn't at the press conference, was led to believe for several days that she was alone in Iran. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, where he's watching the news conference, Glenn O'Glazer, correspondent for Sky News of Britain. And Glenn, just first, this did seem to us to be quite a moment. Are we right?
Oh, I think so, Robin. I think this was a revelation. And we saw all these chill pics of the 50 British sailor Marines on Indian television while being held in captivity, eating fruit, playing chess, drinking coffee, looking relaxed, dressed casually, not in uniforms, bare in some of those pictures. But I think we heard about some of the reality behind that.
Well, I'm not only speaking of that, and we want to hear more of what the sailors said, but just the fact that troops would hold a press conference.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it would have been extraordinary if they hadn't held a press conference, having been released. I mean, that's normal in hostage situations, is it not, for the hostages, no matter how long they've been held for, to talk to the press and talk a little bit about their ordeal. Sometimes it takes a bit of time for people to be debriefed and have some counselling before they're able to do that. But at least these six of the 15 were clearly able to do this pretty quickly and talk about the sort of ordeal they've had to endure.
Well, Faye Turney, the woman who, as we said, wasn't in attendance today, and another sailor had apologized on Iranian television. Now, we understand from reports that the whole group was criticized in Britain afterwards for the apologies, for talking at all, for giving anything other than name, rank, and serial. Lieutenant Carman said today, at no time did we apologize. What do you make of that, given that crew members, in fact, had apologized on television? What's happening there?
Well, he was one of them, and he didn't apologize. And the reason he's able to say that is because, if you remember, he used the word apparently. We had apparently strayed into Iranian waters. And today he said, whatever we said before, the fact of the matter is that we were 1.7 nautical miles inside Iraqi waters. And the leader of this group, Captain Chris Eyre, a Royal Marines captain, explained how they really had no choice but to comply with the Iranians at first when they were captured, because they were simply surrounded by vastly superior forces. And he said that to have tried to fight it out would have led to a massive loss of life, and they would have lost. They were outgunned by heavy machine guns, RPGs, and so on. And that the Iranians had deliberately, in his view, entered Iraqi waters specifically to capture them, to seize them. But also, once they were seized and they're in captivity, again, his line is that they didn't have a choice but to comply. And he and the others was, look, we had a choice of either saying what they wanted us to say and going home, or facing 7 years in jail. And given that, we felt the right thing to do. And it has to be said on his behalf that he has actually got all 15 Royal Marines and sailors home safely and in one piece. Now, if he'd followed some other route, perhaps that wouldn't have been the case.
Right.
And bear in mind the psychological pressure, Robin. Guns cocked to their heads, blindfolded, held in isolation. Fake Turney, the only woman involved, isolated and told for about 4 days that the others had all gone home. Huge psychological pressure on them to say what the Iranians wanted them to say.
And we rush to say that on the BBC, the head of the British Navy defended the conduct of the sailors and Marines, but he admitted it was not our finest hour. Former British military officer Charles Heyman has questioned training and support. What did the crew say about their training, if anything?
Well, Captain Chris Eyre, again, the Royal Marine captain, said that they did have rules. They had had some training, and they did have rules to follow. But as I was saying, he said they were not prepared to fight a heavily armed force who'd clearly come into Iraqi waters to take them prisoner. He says that reasoning with the Iranians was our only option. The head of the Navy, Admiral Jonathan Band, says that they acted with dignity and a lot of courage and appear to have played it by the rules. and not put themselves into danger or others into danger or given anything away. So I think he's exonerated their behavior. And again, Captain Chris Eyre says that they were conscious that had they started a firefight with the Iranians, that could have led to a major international incident apart from the obvious loss of life.
Glenn O'Glaser, Washington correspondent for Sky News of Britain, on a pretty extraordinary press conference by the former captives today. Glenn, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
The second of four reports to be released this year on the state of the planet's climate came out today, and as expected, the news is dismal. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicts that global warming could endanger millions of people worldwide due to food and water shortages, floods, and the spread of tropical diseases. In the U.S., the report says we'll see more violent storms, and areas along the U.S.-Mexico border, cities like Las Vegas and Phoenix, will face Dust Bowl-scale droughts. Worldwide, we'll see more crop failures, melting glaciers, species going extinct, drowning polar bears. Every time we report on this story, we get emails from you asking, what can I do? Well, funny you should ask. Editors at Time Magazine are offering a global warming survival guide, and joining us now is senior editor Jeffrey Kluger. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You write about what countries, cities, lawmakers can do, but when it comes to individuals, you give us some incentive because you guys write that while China and India are looming producers of emissions, Americans are far and away the winners with per capita emission of carbon dioxide. In fact, 25 tons of each American's CO2 emissions each year is from our houses.
That's right, from our houses. And that's one of the first things we can do is ditch the McMansions. Look, there's plenty to be said for having the money for a big, spacious home and for all the prestige that it comes with, and that's great if you can do it. But there's a point past which big becomes big for big's own sake. And the fact is that even an energy-inefficient small house has a much smaller carbon footprint than a very energy-efficient big house.
Well, the key words in your report are mitigation and adaptation. What's the difference between the two when it comes to global warming?
Mitigation is one of the things we have to do, and adaptation is one of the things we shouldn't have to do, but we must because we've been such slobs with the planet. Mitigation basically means dialing back our carbon and whatever other waste and pollutants we put into the stream. Adaptation has to do with the fact that no matter what we do, there's a lot of carbon still in the pipeline. There's another degree of warming minimum still in the pipeline. Even if we could magically snap our fingers and go to an effective cap and trade system well past the Kyoto Accords today, even if we could do it, we're still on a glide path for at least another degree of warming.
Okay. Well, as we said, there are 51 things the person can do to, as you say, move the carbon needle down. So let's go through some more. You say turn off the computer when not using it. So just putting up a screensaver, not enough.
The problem with screensavers is that they still take energy to run.
In fact, you write the U.S. Department of Energy says 75% of all energy used in homes is consumed by standby power?
By standby power, that's right, which is basically the old canard we've been hearing all these years, that, well, it takes more energy to turn your computer on and off than it does to keep it running. Well, that's actually untrue. This isn't the case with computers.
Huh. We've talked here about changing conventional light bulbs to compact fluorescents. They last longer, but they cost more, and you have to dispose of them properly.
That's right.
But you say hang up a clothesline and let the sun dry your clothes. Really, how much of a difference could that make?
That makes actually a very big difference. 60% of the energy associated with a piece of clothing is spent washing and drying it. And over the course of its lifetime, a single T-shirt puts 9 pounds of carbon dioxide into the air.
Huh.
So when you think about all the T-shirts most of us own, particularly if you wear one every day, particularly if you wear an extra one going to the gym, that really adds up. That's 9 pounds of carbon dioxide in the course of a lifetime.
Staying with clothing, buy retro, buy vintage clothing because it saves the cost of making a new, which is another huge emission maker. Recycle clothing?
Recycle fleece clothing because it can be used, as the word recycle suggests, it can be used in other kinds of materials. It can be used in bedding. It can be used in blankets. It can be used in sleeping bags. And all of this eliminates the need to remanufacture the same stuff.
Huh. So find a place that'll take recycled fleece. Okay, let's move to buildings. You say move to a high rise.
That's right. Moving to a high-rise, keep in mind, New York City, for all of its image of dirt and rubbish, is in fact one of the greenest cities in the world, and the reason is that there's absolutely no sprawl footprint aside from whatever the rectangle of the building is. People stack on top of one another, and firing up a single building and then everybody sipping from the same power source is very different from having to run lines to houses all over a sprawling suburb and fire up individual houses.
Plus, they drive less.
Plus, you drive less, exactly. Yeah. We drive less, there's much more walking, there's less car ownership altogether, simply because people just don't need it. And when we had our obesity and fitness conference a couple of years ago, at time we were exploring the inverse relationship between sprawl and weight. People who live in tightly compressed places where there's high density of population are at precisely the opposite end of the weight and fitness spectrum as people who live in places where you have to drive.
Staying with buildings, you've got two prime examples of green buildings, the new federal building in San Francisco, the Bank of America in New York. Just briefly, tell us what's so special about them.
These two and the entire other new generation of green buildings take advantage of a lot of simple environmental fixes. There are fins on the exterior of the San Francisco building, for example, that sort of open and close like slats that regulate, A, the amount of sunlight that gets in day to day. They're automatically regulated, which keeps temperature within a reasonable range in the building and also keeps the need for artificial lighting, whether it's incandescents or fluorescent lights, down. It also creates what the architects refer to as a circulation engine around the building that keeps natural air flowing in the building. Remember, every building has its own impact on wind, and when you're in a place like San Francisco off the windy bay, you can take advantage of a lot of that. That keeps fresh air in the building, keeps the need for air conditioning and heating down.
Right. And meanwhile, if I'm working in the building and I'm a guy, mm-hmm. You say lose the tie and jacket. This is amazing. During an energy conservation experiment in 2005, Japanese workers took off their dark blue business suits and put on, open collars and tropical
collars? That's right.
And they saved an estimated 70,000 tons of carbon dioxide because they could keep their office temperatures up at 82 because they were cooler.
That's right. And in the issue, we have three matrices on which we can grade these things: impact, time horizon, and the feel-good factor. Now, the feel-good factor of this one is very high, and the feel-good factor often isn't consistent with the impact factor, but the time horizon is immediate, and that's a very important thing about all of these things, that the more you can do that's going to have an effect right away, the greater the impact is of what you're doing.
We're talking with Jeffrey Kluger, senior editor at Time Magazine, about the magazine's 51 things that you can do to slow global warming. Here is a few more. Number 24, just say no to plastic bags. 5 million of them are handed out every year at stores, and only 3% get recycled. The rest go to landfills. Number 26, plant a bamboo fence. Bamboo grows quickly, you have to keep an eye on it, but it absorbs more carbon than, say, a rhododendron. Skip the steak. According to the UN, the international meat industry generates about 18% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Today, there are about 3 billion animals on the planet bred just for meat, so cutting down your consumption makes your carbon footprint smaller, but it would also be welcomed by the cows. And we've got an email from Ed Andrews of Malden, Mass. He says, don't just turn off your computer to save energy in the home. Shut down those power strips that power computers and televisions when they're not being used. He did that about 6 weeks ago. He's already noticed a difference. We'll have more tips after the break, here and now. Young, it's Here and Now, and we're back with Time senior editor Jeffrey Kluger with his magazine's Global Warming Survival Guide, just in time as the world's climate scientists are out with their latest report card on climate change. The grades are poor. As we've been hearing, there are things we can do to slow global warming. Jeffrey, next on your list, green banking. You say there's a whole movement underway, bankers like Peter Liu investing in new energy. But how does where I put my money or how I pay my bills connect to global warming?
Green banking makes a big difference in global warming because, remember, every time you pay your bills, somebody has to train or truck or fly these things from one place to another. If everybody in the U.S. paid their bills online, you could save 1.6 billion tons of paper a year and take 2.1 million tons of CO2 out of the air simply by doing it electronically.
And if you invest with investor like Peter Liu, or I'm thinking of Amy Dominey, people who are into slow money investments or investing in environmentally conscious projects.
This is another thing that one of the folks we spoke to in one of the other stories was talking about the green movement being the internet movement of the 21st century. Now, out whether this is or isn't. I mean, that's quite a dream for people investing in green technology. But the fact is there's already a great deal of venture capital flowing into green enterprises. Some $450 million flowed to green startups in Silicon Valley alone last year. Wall Street is waking up to this, and they're also trying to rein in their investors who need immediate feedback on things, immediate payoff and constant annual growth almost from the moment a company is launched. Investors who are investing in green are investing with the understanding that there's going to be a slower ramp up but a bigger payoff.
Okay, it's spring, wedding season. You write you can have a green wedding, buy everything locally. And if your guests are traveling long distances, you can offset their trip's carbon emissions by making a donation to a renewable energy project. Or you also talk about buying carbon offsets. This is sort of the guilt money you pay to offset the use of cars or air flight. But you know you have to be careful because critics of these carbon credits say you don't really have a guarantee where your money's going. So first
That's
of all,
right.
Remind us of these credits. How are they supposed to work?
There are a number of places online that you can go, and simply Googling energy credits will give you all the places that do this. There are a lot of places you can go that will allow you to invest in companies that are involved in green technology. You can invest in recycling groups. You can invest in companies or in organizations that are researching, say, biofuels. And what this does is allow you to calculate the carbon output, the emission output that you're creating by, say, owning a certain kind of car or by having a wedding with X number of guests. It's a very rough thing to calculate.
But now, aren't there organizations that will help you do that?
Sure. There are organizations that will help you do that, and there are also organizations that will help you determine which ones give you the greatest payoff.
Well, we'll put that information on our website. Okay, let's move to working. You say, my boss should let me work at home if I can and cut down on my commutes. That would be nice. But also, employers who have multiple sites around a region should really think about putting people nearer to where they work.
Well, sure. We explored some of these kinds of strategies that have been adopted by Starbucks, by Boeing, and most recently by Seattle's fire department. In Seattle, for example, only 4% of firefighters worked at the station closest to their home. If you've got a workforce that you're distributing in various offices like this, think about geography before you make your assignments.
Okay, so let's say I am driving. Can I choose biofuels now? I mean, we're understanding and reading your article that ethanol made from corn still takes almost as much energy to make it as it saves.
That's right. Ethanol is, at this point, at best, it will be a partial solution. The problem is, as you say, it takes a lot of energy to produce it. As one of the folks we talked to said, you know, if you're burning coal to produce a clean fuel, you're making something clean in a dirty way, and it's a wash.
So in the meantime, what's the best way to save on gas?
First of all, if you can get a hybrid, by all means do. If you can carpool or take mass transit, by all means do. But there are simple things like simply inflating your tires properly or cleaning your fuel lines properly or having proper and periodic tune-ups. All of these things dramatically increase fuel efficiency, in some cases almost as much as a hybrid would, or at least the lower-end hybrids.
Or make only right turns. This is one of my absolute favorites. This is number 45. And I guess it's been tried out by UPS, which which decided what? That its drivers wouldn't make left turns because when you make a left turn, you have to sit at the light, where if you make a right turn, you can, in most places, go through the light?
That's right. You can make a right turn. First of all, it's easier to make a right turn because you're not turning against traffic.
Oh,
and
right.
Second of all, most places do have right turn on red. It's the idling that's deadly, particularly with city driving. And currently, UPS drivers tried to set their routes up so that 83% of their turns are right turns. Now, you really have to have a certain kind of spatial reasoning brain to do this, but if you can figure it out and you know your familiar local routes, why not?
I love this. They have a software program that they use to map out the routes. And so right now, this is just in New York, I guess, right now.
Right.
They are just giving them the routes with largely right-hand turns, and they're going to adopt that policy nationwide in 2 years.
That's right. I mean, we can learn from this.
We can learn from all of this. This is an amazing list, Jeffrey. A question, why stop at 51, which, by the way, number 51 is meditate, do less, consume less, share more, live simply. Very philosophical ending there. But why 51?
Well, 51 seemed to be manageable. It seemed to be a short enough list so that people could sort of wrap their brains around it, and so that we could here at the magazine also, and long enough so that there are a sufficient number of options for everybody to try something. But keep in mind also that this is only what we can do at the retail level, at the person-to-person level, and that's colossally important. But also important is for the people with their hands on the levers of power to move those levers. And that's industry, and that's science, and that's government. And those are really the big three. Now, I would say that's half the problem, and we individually are half of the problem. But if we're not all working together in this, it's going to take exponentially longer to fix the problem.
Jeffrey, its time has come, it would seem. Jeffrey Kluger, senior editor at Time. For more on the magazine's Global Warming Survival Guide, go to our website, here-now.com. Jeffrey, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Well, look ahead for us now. Next week on Here and Now, warrior politics. Should the soldiers in the field speak out about policy? One military analyst says that's short-sighted and dangerous. That's next week. Still ahead today, a man who doesn't use a key for his front door. He uses his fingers. He has RFIDs in his hand. That's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. So young, it's Here and Now. When Emil Grafstra opens his front door, he doesn't use a key. To turn on his computer, he doesn't touch his keyboard. He just waves his hand. Emil, who runs a mobile messaging company in Bellingham, Washington, is one of just a few hundred people in the world who have had radio frequency identification tags, or RFIDs, implanted under their skin. In Emil's case, they're between the thumb and index finger of each hand. He writes about his experience in IEEE Spectrum. That's the terrific magazine for electrical engineers, and joins us now. Welcome.
Hello.
I'm fascinated. Can you see it in your hands? If I were to look at your hands, can I see these things?
Well, I was very careful to have the doctors place them just under the skin and not any deeper. So if I position my hands in a certain way and kind of push up from underneath, you can definitely see them.
Ew. I mean, I understand it's about the size of a piece of rice.
It's a little larger, yeah. I have two different sizes, actually, one in my right and left hand.
I mean, I had a hard time piercing my ears. I mean, were you concerned about having this foreign object in your hand?
No, not really. I mean, if you think about it, people that do get their ears pierced or pacemakers put in or false hips or false teeth or, I mean, people put in foreign objects into their body all the time. Mm-hmm. And really it's just a chip and an antenna encased in glass, which your body doesn't recognize. It doesn't interact with your body. It just kind of sits there like World War II shrapnel.
Do you ever just want to take them out? I mean, is this something that you're constantly thinking about or?
No, actually. At first I was like, hey, whoa, you know, kind of always poking at it and you know, kind of mindlessly rubbing my hand just to feel the tag under there. But that all stopped probably a couple weeks after I got my first one. Just, you know, I rarely realize that they're there until I go to actually use them.
Well, now tell us how it works. You say that it's this tiny little piece with an antenna. How does it work?
Well, they're both passive devices, which is great, which means there's no battery, there's no power source. So it's just a chip and an antenna, and that antenna is tuned to a certain frequency. So when the reader, you bring the chip, the tag, within range of the reader, the signal from the reader actually powers up. It inducts power into this antenna, and then the chip spits out its identification. And then the reader picks that up and then does something with it. And whatever it does, it's kind of up to how you hook it all up.
Well, what are some of the things that it does in your case?
Like, say, I have two different chips. So the simple chip, it just spits out an ID, and then the reader, like for my front door, for example, it will check that ID against a list of authorized IDs. And if it is in that list, it opens the door. If it's not in the list, it can do any number of things. It can just deny it, and that's it. Or it can log it, you know, or it can even send me a text message saying, hey, someone's trying to get in your door.
And what are some of the other things it opens or starts?
Well, it starts my motorcycle. It opens my car door and my house door. And if I had an office door, then I would do that too. But currently don't have an office, work from home. So,
well, why did you do this?
Actually, I did it because many years ago, I had a different company called Morpheus, and we did a lot of server management for medical facilities and things like that. And I was always carrying large, heavy, bulky items into and out of my office door. And the office door was one that locked and closed automatically. So, you know, I hated fishing around for my keys to be able to get in. So I looked around for technology that could let me in that wouldn't need me to carry around another key card or another key or something like that, where I could just walk up, open the door. And I looked into biometric technology like face scanning, fingerprint reading, that kind of stuff. And at the time, it was really expensive and difficult to implement, with a lot of overhead and a lot of equipment in the background that needed to be set up in order to make it work. So RFID was a cheap and simple solution. I just didn't, you know, you have to carry around a key card to be able to use RFID. And so I started looking at the pets, you know, getting their RFID implants, and looking at different uses in the medical industry that were being discussed at the time. And so I started looking around for implantable RFID tags, and found a few like Verichip and like the pet tags, ruled them out for various reasons. And then
Back up, because Verichip, that's the tag some people have implanted, and it can be scanned by doctors during emergencies, and then they can be directed towards the private information of that patient. What's the difference between your chip and those?
Well, there's some physical differences as well as some kind of implementation differences. The physical differences really are that the Verichip is an FDA-approved human RFID implant, and it's approved for use in the upper arm. It has a coating on it that makes the implant more or less permanent. I didn't want that location, and I didn't want the permanence, and I also didn't want to be registered in Verichip's, you know, patient database.
So you have chosen these RFIDs. We understand they cost about $2 each for those little tags, but then you spend how much more for the reader?
The cheap and simple tag in my left hand is about $2, and the reader is about $30 to $50. You can find them really cheap, and you can use them in various projects and things. The tag in my right hand is a Philips HiTag, and it supports data storage, so I can actually put data on the chip, as well as an encryption scheme, so I can protect that data. But the reader that supports both reading and writing data as well as encryption, that costs a lot more. It's like $400. So it depends on what you're implementing and how secure you need it to be.
Well, we know you've had some odd reactions to this. You got letters from concerned Christians, including your mom?
Yeah, my mom had some concerns about it. And, you know, people are concerned. For a multitude of reasons. Some people believe that it's, you know, kind of the coming of the end of the world, mark of the beast, which, you know, we'll all receive a mark of some kind and be forced into slavery or sell our souls, you know, that kind of thing. The other thing is that there are some valid concerns about security and privacy when used in a, you know, infrastructure like government or payment or, you know, stuff like that, where, you know, if I'm using it in my personal life, and it really doesn't extend beyond that, and the technology is great.
And we understand now that you and your fiance, Jennifer Tomlin, can, you know, waltz down the aisle together with matching RFID implants. She has them too?
She has one. She has the simple one that's called an EM4102. It just has a very simple ID.
Well, now, is this to your house?
Actually, both.
It's a whole new territory because, you know, I mean, I'm sure you're going to have a happy ever after, but if you do break up, you have to say, okay, give me back the RFID.
Well, not really. That's the thing. Like in a traditional lock system, the locks are key-centric, which means that you have one unique key and all the locks, you know, use that key. So you have to distribute keys. But in an RFID system, it's lock-centric. So you have one lock, and then you program with these different IDs. So if we ever did break up, I'd just remove her ID, and she'd do the same.
How much further are you going to go? Any more implants you think you want to do?
I think I'm set. I did have an idea for an implant that I saw some other people doing, where they actually took some very small, very powerful magnets and put them into one of the fingertips on their hands, and that was to gain like a sixth sense, where they could detect electromagnetic fields. They could detect metals and, you know, things like that, just because the magnet in their fingertip would start to vibrate when they got within range of these things. I thought that was kind of cool. But aside from that, really no plans for any further implants. I think I'm set with what I got. So,
Emil Grafstra, an entrepreneur based in Bellingham, Washington, his article "Me and My RFIDs," which are implanted in his hands, appears in the March edition of the IEEE Spectrum magazine. For more on RFIDs, go to our website, here-now.org. Emil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In this quick news note, yesterday we mentioned the controversy around the singer Sanjaya on the TV show American Idol. Well, American Idol on our radar again today. Xinhua, the Xinhua news agency in China, is reporting that authorities there are issuing guidelines for the Chinese edition of American Idol, which airs next month. The show starts May 1st. It's called Happy Boy's Voice. It's a sequel to the hugely popular Supergirl's Voice. The state says no weirdness, no vulgarity, and no making fun of the contestants. So, no Simon Cowell. More ahead here now. Well, thank goodness the madness of college basketball is over because we have more time for the insanity of baseball. Here in Boston, we have Daisuke Mania, Red Sox pitching ace Daisuke Matsuzaka. I've got to, Phil, I need help.
Matsuzaka was pretty good.
Thank you. Here to talk about that, as well as his own particular love, professional soccer, and the rest of the news from the world of sports, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. And it's because we just call him Daisuke here in Boston.
That has become the way to talk about him.
And
yes,
to remind everyone, the Red Sox are paying him $52 million, $51 million to his former team, $103 million overall. So how'd he do?
Well, I don't think he threw the gyro ball, Robin, because I don't think he needed it in freezing weather against Kansas City. He may be saving it for a night game during the middle of the summer against the Yankees.
What is this thing, the gyro ball?
Well, it is his alleged secret pitch. But the way he has been going, at least in spring training and the one start that he's had, his fastball may do most of the damage and the gyro ball may be unnecessary.
He pitched 7 innings, struck out 10 as the Sox beat the Royals 4-1. But our technical director, Doug Sugarts, wants us to mention his favorite team, the Pittsburgh Pirates. They started the season 3-0.
Yes, and there are several other undefeated teams in the early going, Minnesota, Los Angeles, the Mets, the Braves, as well as the Pirates. I don't think any of them are going to go undefeated all season, but it's kind of fun to dream.
Yes, for at least this first week. Okay, just ticking off some other sports events. Let's see, professional golf's first major, the Masters Tournament, underway in Augusta, Georgia. We hear last year's champion, Phil Mickelson, had a terrible first round today. But to Major League Soccer, it kicks off its season this weekend. English soccer great David Beckham is not going to join the LA Galaxy until July. He's just on the cover of all those entertainment magazines with his wife. He has to finish out his contract with his team in Madrid. So until then, what are we looking for?
Well, there are lots of interesting things to look for this time around. DC United has traded away Freddy Adu, the poster boy before David Beckham signed on in that role, and they have signed a Brazilian player, one of the many Brazilian players who goes by a single name, in this case, Fred, which one would not have thought would be a common name in Brazil, but there you are.
Fred.
Bruce Arena with the New York Red Bulls, the coach of the New York Red Bulls, has used his designated player slot to bring Claudio Reyna home, who is, of course, an American who has played overseas for many years and played on the U.S. national team. But that's kind of fun that he's not bringing somebody from some exotic soccer nation. He's bringing an American home. He's 33 years old, Reyna is, but he may still be. Great fun to watch. See if the Red Bulls get off to a fast start.
Okay. Moving to football, a couple sad passings we just want to note. Former New England Patriot player Daryl Stingley, who was paralyzed in that terrible hit so many years ago, died yesterday at the age of 55. And this week also saw the passing of Grambling college football coach Eddie Robinson. He was at Grambling for 57 years. He was one of a kind.
Eddie Robinson was at Grambling before it was called Grambling. It was something normal school back in the day. He built a program, no question about that. And he is not only a sort of one of a kind, but a real throwback in these days when coaches jump from school to school every couple of years and always say it isn't about the money. I think of Eddie Robinson, you really could say it wasn't about the money.
Right, right. Won 408 games at that small black college.
And sent God knows how many of his players to the pros, which is, by according to some people, the measure of a program's success.
Hundreds. And what he said, I just want to note, he said, the real record I have set for over 50 years is the fact that I have had one job and one wife. Admirable. Well, finally, just briefly, and returning to baseball, Barry Bonds continuing his quest to surpass Hank Aaron's home run record. Your producer, Karen Givens, from Only a Game, is in San Francisco. What's the town there saying about this?
Well, Karen has found fans saying all sorts of things. One of my favorites is a guy who just flat out said, I don't care if he's taking all the steroids in the world, I'm a Barry Bonds fan. I hope he hits 11 million home runs, that kind of thing. There are people who will be happy when this record has been set and Bonds can retire and the circus can end. But San Francisco is the one place where they still applaud him pretty much without restraint.
Well, and you will be reporting on that, the one place you can get that and everything else in the world of sports on Bill's show, Only a Game on NPR. Be sure to check that out. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. The music of Martin Sexton is just ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Martin Sexton was just a kid in Catholic school when he realized that singing Stevie Wonder tunes would make him the center of attention with the kids, and unfortunately, the nuns.
You and I, here all along. Sunday morning, here at home. The sky is blue as the coffee's strong.
Sexton went on to sell 20,000 copies of his demo recordings out of his guitar case while working the streets back in the early 90s. He landed a major label deal and then asked to get out of it to start his own Kitchen Table Records. And this week he's out with a new CD called Seeds. And Martin Sexton is here to tell us more. Welcome.
I feel very welcome. Thank you.
How would you describe yourself? Because I'm thinking of how I want to do it, and yet every song on this new CD puts you in about, you know, in a different category. So how would you describe yourself?
Soul music. It comes from my soul. It's soulfully sung, and it's simple, and it's as honest as I can be, and I think that's what soul music is.
You took an unconventional approach to writing this new CD. As you say, you wrote the music first, kind of scattered the lyrics, and then wrote them later. And the result is words that you said are maybe grammatically incorrect or incorrect phrasing, but they are that soul you speak of. Can you give us an example of, let's say, a line that sort of just kind of got cobbled together? And then why did you do it that way?
Well, let's see. I remember on Happy, I was just playing the piano, and I'd be making words up like, you and I here all alone. Honey, I don't even have a lawn.
A lawn.
Which actually became Loving You All Night Long and then Sleeping on Our Front Lawn. So the little mistakes and just jibber-jabber actually made their way into every song. And sometimes they don't make a whole lot of sense, but they come from immediacy.
We heard the song Happy in the introduction. And happy you must be. I mean, you took a gamble. You got a home label, your wife, perhaps the honey, you know, with you on the road as your manager. And a lot of people, you know, snapping up tickets. You did it in a kind of an unconventional way. It seems to be working.
It really is working. It's a great time to be an independent artist. I have lost that need for the big corporate middleman to present me to my listeners. With everything the way it is, with the internet and with YouTube and with just good stations like these that play these type of shows, there's a wonderful network that gets me to my listeners, so that I don't have to take orders from any particular corporate entities. I didn't have to sell any cars or any Diet Colas to get this record to, or my career to where it is.
Well, let's listen to a little more of the result. Let's listen to the Cut Wild Angels on the new Martin Sexton CD, Seeds.
And we are wild angels, believing in our child. Trying to find our way back to the source of the stream. We are wild and free.
Martin Sexton, there's a spirituality in your music too. Where's that from?
I guess it's from being a person who comes from a certain tradition of Catholicism, but who has shed that skin and left myself open to a different brand of spirituality, one that doesn't have a label. It's just a sense of a conscious contact with my higher power, who I choose to call God. And again, no middleman between me and my spirituality.
How did that shedding of the Catholic skin go over with the family of 12 children in Syracuse that you come from? I mean, how'd that...
It's nothing I really talk about when we get together at Thanksgiving. I don't talk about how I pray or how I find my connection with my higher power.
How much to being one of 12 shape you or your music? That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's six boys and six girls. And I think my sense of performance and my improvisation is a direct result of being one of 12 kids. I think I did just about anything and everything to gain attention as a small child. So I do wacky things, you know, to get attention. And like I learned as a street artist that I have to do something different, you know, like, you know, to maybe turn ahead and what was that? And then do something else to keep them interested.
That's like a muted trumpet with your mouth.
Yeah, it's like the Charlie Brown adult voice trumpet, you know, and but just to do anything to get the attention and then maybe do something else to hold the attention and basically get them to drop that dollar bill in my guitar case or buy that record.
Well, and what caught our attention on the new Seeds CD, the Billy Preston tune, Will It Go Round in Circles. I read you recorded that song on the day that he died of kidney failure. Let's listen.
I got a song that ain't got no melody. I'm gonna sing it to my friends. I got a song that ain't got no melody. I'm gonna sing it to my friends.
Who else is in the mix of who shaped Martin Sexton? What other voices are in your head?
My main vocal influences would be Stevie Wonder, Robert Plant, Mel Torme, Al Jarreau, Bobby McFerrin, Jeff Buckley.
Now there's a band.
Right, there's a band, all right. Of course, the Beatles. That's what the roux of my sauce would be, vocally.
Martin Sexton, his new CD is Seeds. We talked about, you know, growing up with Catholic nuns and singing Led Zeppelin, you know, in the schoolyard and having spirituality as part of your soul sound. And I'm thinking as we leave with the song Still Think About You, that it feels as if you are working out a lot about your feelings about God,
right,
that power through your music.
I am. My music is my vent, is my my channel. And I like to view myself as a channel of God, as we all can be, as children of God. I don't mean to be religious sounding, but I think in that song, I Still Think About You, it could be about a lover or maybe even someone who left something like a church behind or some old job or who knows what. And it's just that kind of mournful movement, that change. It's always hard to change, and I guess that song is sort of about that, and holding on to certain things, little souvenirs that we keep from our past.
Martin Sexton's new CD, Seeds. For more about his tour, go to our website, here-now.org. Martin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I fancy myself a rambling man, singing is my game. I wasn't born to ramble, but I ramble just the same. I'm wondering about...
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shergetz is our engineer, our web producer, Ken George, interns Huda Ahmed, Austin Mayfield, and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman, senior producer of Here and Now, Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, happy Easter, and join us again, Here and Now.
Years have given me so much good, most people have been kind. But six says I'll stay, and seven says I'll ride. Is it a future I'm waging or just charting a past? It's a question posed to the rearview glasses. I still think about you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.